Welcome in to the Towel Boys. He's Mike Grimala from RunRev.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff over here at Mountain West Connection. And talking about Chris Wood. He's gone. I had probably a 48-hour span where I thought he was coming back. And so we'll get into that. Also, we'll get into the reaction to his video, which might be the most interesting part at this point in the process. Plus what it means for UNLV, and we'll also talk about Ike Nwamu, because we haven't talked about Ike Nwamu, because UNLV happened to get Steven Zimmerman to commit before we recorded our last one. But we'll talk about Ike. He said who his final three were. UNLV, one of those three. But with Chris Wood, he's going pro. He released a four-minute video, pissed a lot of people off because the video was nice. I think Ed Graney called him immature in his column, among other things. Is Chris Wood like childish or something because of how he handled this situation?
It's not the ideal way to handle it, I guess, because it sounded like he did know for, you know, at least a few days that, you know, he was going to the NBA and failed to communicate that with the coaching staff for whatever reason. You know, I'm sure he's got his reasons. He wants to make his own announcement. He doesn't want it leaking out, whatever. But yeah, that's probably not the sort of thing you want to send in via a text message. I'm sure Dave Rice probably thought a little more of their relationship than, you know, just getting a text message like saying, "Hey, I'm out," or, you know, whatever it said. I'm sure it was much more heartfelt than that.
I hope it said, "Hey, I'm out." Yeah, I hope that's what it was.
But I mean, even if it's more heartfelt than that, even if, you know, Chris Wood is like pouring out all his thanks and everything in that text message, it's still a text message. So, I mean, it only goes so far. So I can kind of see from that perspective that you probably wanted a little bit more from him. If you were the coaching staff, you probably wanted a little bit more of a respectful exit than that.
As far as the fan standpoint, Chris Wood tweeted out that picture and he said, like, looks good or something, and it was him. And in the background, it was, you know, Ben Carter, Good Luck Okonobo, and Steven Zimmerman. He had his profile picture on Twitter was like a cartoon version of him. I think he was in the UNLV jersey, and like there was a money and a contract and a sneaker, and it looked as though he was like ignoring those things and paying attention to UNLV. And basically, I mean, he teased UNLV fans.
He got you.
He got me.
He got
now,
you.
I had a separate reason, not just his tweets, to think he was coming back as well. But anyway, he got people, I mean, to thinking like, hey, you know, he might actually be coming back. They might actually have Chris Wood and Steven Zimmerman next year. With the video, though, and I guess that's the part that pissed people off, because it was a 4.5-minute video, and it was a fairly quality made video. A couple things, though. First off, the video wasn't made by UNLV. I've seen media members on Twitter assume that it was made by UNLV. It was made by somebody that works for something with Finlay Prep. Somebody associated with Finlay Prep made the video. It wasn't like that amazing of a video, because like Ed Graney wrote a column and said the video was good. It was Jeff Grammer, who covers New Mexico, and Mark Ziegler, who covers San Diego State. Both on Twitter, I saw them say something about the video being nice. Yeah.
I think that you and I do some stuff with video. I mean, I'm not saying like I'm Quentin Tarantino, but I feel if you work with video and do some online editing, you would know that you could probably turn that around in one day. Like,
yeah,
four-minute video like that, you find time to do the sit-down interview, which I'm guessing could be anywhere between, like, you know, 20, 25, 30 minutes.
I don't even think it took that long.
Yeah, depending on how much of it was scripted and how much of, you know, what points they knew they wanted to hit. But, you know, just from saying, let's include the time for setting up and all that stuff. You know, 20, 30 minutes to record the sit-down interview. You organize your B-roll, which, you know, takes a little bit of time. And then you sort of throw it all together. You could turn that around in a day.
Oh, yeah. Like, for those that don't know, I work part-time for a couple radio stations doing, like, I have a business card that says videographer on it. Like, that's what I basically do every day. The hardest part of the video would be getting all of that footage, because they had footage from Finlay Prep, and they had footage from the Arizona game this year, and then they had a bunch of pictures of stuff from Finlay Prep, stuff from UNLV, of all the coaches and all that. That was the hardest part, would be getting all of that. Like, I don't know if they legally got the stuff from CBS Sports Network for the Arizona game, or if they just ripped it off the internet somewhere, and the guy, you know, the Finlay Prep, somebody made the video, so that's where the Finlay Prep video come from. But the hardest part would be getting the footage. Like, once you have your footage, like, it would have taken longer to export a 4.5-minute video than it would to actually edit it together.
Yeah.
So, like Grainy and Ziegler and Grammer are all under the assumption that this video took, like, 2 weeks to make. And there's no way in hell it took that long. Like, it probably spanned 3 days. Yeah. Is probably how long from start to finish. And it's fair to say, like, Chris Wood knew he was going pro when he tweeted out that picture, but it's just, like, this assumption that Chris Wood, like, he's been working on this video yeah. since they lost their last game of the year is kind of ridiculous.
It's not, video editing has come a long way. It's not like Steven Spielberg is in the editing bay with an X-Acto knife, like, splicing together the film of E.T., you know, and it's taking months and months and months. Like you said, it was a pretty basic... highlights and interview, talking heads. Like,
can we rip it apart? Can we mention things that were bad about it?
There were levels issues.
There was one point where you could obviously tell the audio was two separate things, because there was like a click in between it. And my least favorite part, which wasn't like a mistake, was the damn transition of pictures where it had like the blinds thing. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, well, there's like one part where it's transitioning through pictures instead of just like flashing in the next picture. It does. It's like Venetian blinds or something is what the effect
is
called.
Oh, he uses a wipe.
Yeah, a wipe, okay. Yeah. And I think it's actually called Venetian blinds. I might have the wrong name of it, but I hate those. Those are stupid. And then at one point you can hear an airplane flying over, which is... That's the problems of UNLV, because you're right in the flight path. Like, I call UNLV baseball and softball games, and, like, there's about an airplane every inning that comes flying over. So, but like, it wasn't some unbelievable video. It wouldn't have taken that long, and it wouldn't have been that expensive. Ziegler and Grammer were talking to each other on Twitter and somehow accused UNLV of an NCAA violation of improper benefits because of this video.
Yeah, or he knows someone who has a Mac. Like, it's either a huge recruiting violation and a conspiracy to pump Chris Wood to the NBA. Or someone owns a Mac that has Movie Maker installed on it. It's one of those two. I don't know. It could be either one.
Okay. Chris Wood got more compliments for his video on Twitter than he did for averaging a double-double this past year. Just wanted to get that out there. Ed Grainy wrote a column, called him childish, called him immature, and all this. But he had one line in there that I still like can't quite fathom. He said in his column, "This is an ideal case of addition by subtraction. Is Chris Wood like the most taken for granted 15-10 guy ever?"
It's tough to. I guess you're counting on Steven Zimmerman to be addition by multiplication or something. If you expect him to like jump in and have like Chris Wood's impact next year, so. I don't know. Like I got the gist of his column. I understood where he was coming from in terms of the video may not have been the way he announces exit may not have been the best thing. But the addition by subtraction, I'm not sure I'm seeing that.
When we talked about last show, would you rather have Zimmerman or Wood? We both picked Wood because we've seen the guy average 15-10 at Division I basketball. But I did mention, like, you know, he was good, but UNLV wasn't good. So maybe, like, Chris Wood's not a winner. And maybe Chris Wood's, like, somehow a bad teammate and makes people worse or something around him. Which, I guess you could say that. But there's no definitive proof of that.
No.
And so, like, there's no way. To me, like, Grainy said that, but also, like, I have seen so many people say, like, Chris Wood's going to be in the D League. Chris, like, because I wrote a story saying kind of how Chris Wood's game fits in the NBA. And people were like, he doesn't fit in the NBA, and he'll fit in the D-League, or stuff like that. And it's just like, all these people that are angry about him leaving, like, think he's terrible, but yet they would have been super happy if he came back because he's actually good at college basketball.
Yeah, I think the NBA has room for athletic seven-footers who can run and jump and handle the ball and score the way he does. I think he'll he'll get a fair shake. But yeah, it's the... I guess you're anyone who's sort of the addition by subtraction or saying that, you know, they're better off without him is sort of, you're basing that entirely on intangibles, which is something that's very hard to judge, even for beat writers who are around the team constantly. It's hard to sort of judge that and gauge how much of an impact, you know, that really makes. You can, judging people by body language on the court and stuff like that is very dicey. Like you never really know the full story of what's going on. So just like tossing out a blanket statement like this guy is bad in the locker room, or they lose because of his personality for some reason, or his team, you know, he makes his teammates worse somehow. Like that, it's there's no real proof either way. So it's you're dealing in just question marks.
Before we talk about like UNLV from the standpoint, what do you think Chris Wood is in the NBA in the next like 5 years?
5 years, best case scenario, like a LaMarcus Aldridge light, you know, like a stretch four, like
yeah.
A guy who's, you know, he's going to catch the ball and face up, maybe knock in some jumpers, like a pick and pop guy who can play center, maybe in a smaller lineup if he puts on some weight, and can hold his own down there, but mostly is like a matchup problem at power forward. If he can ever find the range, like he's got a nice looking shot. He's definitely confident in it. He was projected to be a pretty good shooter for a big man. We didn't see it in 2 years at UNLV, but if he ever, you know, finds his range and can extend his shot out to the 3-point line, I could see him having a nice little career. That's the best case.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think he's going to stick around in the NBA. Like, I don't think he's going anywhere. I guess it depends on where he goes, and I said something similar about Rashad Vaughn. You're not going to draft Chris Wood and cut him after 2 years because he's not producing, unless he's just awful, because both of those guys are guys that are going to get drafted with like the upside factor. Like they're going to get drafted, oh, this guy's got potential, so you know, if we see signs of improvement through 2 years, we're going to hold on to him because we think he could be really good type situation. So I think he's going to stick around. He might bounce in between the D League and NBA next year depending on what team he gets, what team he ends up on and all that, but I think he's going to be fine. And in 5 years, you know, I could see him being a guy, a consistent rotation player. And I mean, hell, you watch the playoffs and it's about matchups, and it's like Greg Popovich just benches Aaron Baines because he doesn't work against the Clippers. And so maybe he's a guy that randomly gets inserted into a playoff series and, hey, he's a matchup problem for somebody and drops 15 in a playoff game. Like, I can see that from Chris Wood. So I think he'll be fine. Now, from UNLV, who is going to score? No one on the roster next year has ever averaged 10 points at the college level. Pat McCaw averaged 9.6. That's your high. Jerome Seeger's 7. That's your second in terms of points per game in a single season. I think Okunobo and Morgan both averaged 5-something last year, and Ben Carter never averaged more than 3. So who's scoring on this team next year?
You're looking for Pat McCaw to just take a huge leap forward. And the guy that we saw in the second half of the season when he took over that scoring role, you need to see that guy plus some for all of next year. Like, he's got to be the main scorer. It may not be like the most natural role for him, but I think he's probably going to be the guy most qualified to be that type of scorer. But that's just one guy. That's just one guy. Like, you need more than one guy.
Yeah, like, where, I think, is Zimmerman the number two option?
I would probably peg him for that right now. Like, you know he's going to come in and play a huge role. They're not going to do everything they did to bring him in and then not give him touches. Like, he's going to have the ball a lot. He's going to have a lot of chances to score.
Like, can UNLV be successful next year if you have Pat McCaw as the guy, and then you have Zimmerman as a number two option? But then as far as sort of your next level of scoring, can they be successful if it's just random player every game, if Jordan Cornish drops 15 and then Dwayne Morgan has 12 the next game, and then maybe it's Ben Carter going off for 18, can they be successful if they're just sort of randomly getting it for everywhere, or do you think that's too, like, too volatile and they would really need somebody to establish themselves as, like, the number three scorer?
I think you can get by if you've got a strong ensemble cast, if you're going in that direction, and you're running that kind of system where, you know, you're running a lot of guys in and out, you're getting up and down the floor, like, and depending on matchups, I could see it working, but you need everyone. You can't have the instability that they sort of had this year where, you know, guys would go in the tank for games at a time. You can't have people who are just non-contributors if you're going to play that, if you're counting on, you know, the rest of the team to pick up the slack. You can't have non-contributors. You need everyone to sort of be playing well, and then when it's their turn, just sort of step up and amplify that a little bit and kick in a little more on any given night. So I could see it working. It depends on the personnel and how much progress the rest of the team makes, because it's all young guys coming back for sophomore years. It just depends on how well they develop.
I actually like the idea of different guys being the third option based on matchups. Like, to me, that sort of, like, makes the most sense. Like, okay, we've got our top two guys, and then, you know, if we're playing a small team, maybe it'll be Okonobo or Ben Carter. If we're playing a team that plays a lot of zone, maybe it's Jordan Cornish. Like, I like that idea, but it relies on, you know, whoever that guy is that you think exploits the matchup being on that day. Or, you know, maybe if it's Dwayne Morgan that you think exploits the matchup, and then all of a sudden he's got three fouls in the first 5 minutes, well, then maybe you don't end up getting a third guy to score a lot of points that game, and you are counting too much on two guys. So I like it, but to me it's too volatile, and especially with younger guys. Now, maybe if you had a much older team that you could maybe count on a guy like, okay, he could give us 10 or 12 if we need him to, or he'll just sit back, play some defense, and rebound if it's not a good matchup. But with younger guys, I don't know that you can count on it quite as much. So I, you know, still going to be questioning who's going to score for this team as we go in to next season.
How about this for an option for that third scorer? Ike Nwamu.
I do sort of like that idea. Did he average 15 last year at Mercer? Is that what the number was? I do, like, Ike Nwamu is a guy that I love. I covered Ole Miss for 2 years. I covered probably Ike Nwamu's best ever game against Ole Miss, where he scored 24 points on 9 of 16 shooting when Mercer went in and beat Ole Miss at Ole Miss. He also scored 30 on Tennessee one time, so maybe that's his best career game. But one of his top two games, like, I covered. So I love him way more than I probably should. But he's like a freaking bowling ball. Like, he just gets to the basket is what he does, and he'll bounce off of people like Derrick Rose sort of will bounce off of people, which might not always be a good thing. But I love him more than I should. He's good in transition. He was pretty good last year as an isolation player. And he actually shot a lot last year. The year I covered him, he wasn't a shooter. Like, he just didn't shoot threes. But last year, he shot a lot of threes. And that helped his points per game average go up. And his three-point shooting, I think in his career at Mercer, he was somewhere near, like, 39% or 40% for his whole career. So he's a pretty good shooter, but shot a lot more as last year. But I love the guy so much just because he was so much fun to watch. And if UNLV gets him, I'll be super pumped.
And the thing that would be enticing for UNLV, I think, is that if you look at their projected lineup for next year, he sort of can play that third guard / small forward type of role, like out on the wing, where they may have the biggest opening. Like,
do you think he's an immediate starter? Like, if he comes to UNLV, is he an immediate starter next year?
I think the last time we talked, we had Jordan Cornish taking that spot, you know, and Dwayne Morgan sort of chipping in there as well. But if Nwamu can beat out those guys, and if you're bringing him in as a grad transfer, as a senior, you've got him for 1 year, and he's a guy who's averaged 15 points a game in college basketball, like, I would expect him to, if not start, you know, he'd at least be in the running, and he'd, you know, get a chance to earn that job.
So the situation with Nwamu, if you don't know, he went to Mercer, he's a grad transfer, so he's got 1 year left, he's immediately eligible, so he doesn't have to sit out a year. Wherever he goes, he can play next year. he tweeted that his final three schools are UNLV, Nevada, and Pitt. So UNLV's in the final three right there. He's taken a visit to all three, as far as Twitter has told me so far. So UNLV's got a really good chance to get him in the final three, and he'll be eligible next year. He's a wing player. I think he's an automatic plug-in starter, mainly because I'm lower on Dwayne Morgan than most people. And even though I like Jordan Cornish a lot, he didn't offer as much outside of his awesome shooting as you would like. So to me, Ike Nwamu is an immediate, like, all right, he's our small forward or our third guard, whatever you want to call it. So you'd go Seegers, McCaw, and then have Nwamu as your third guy starting on the perimeter. I do have a question. Do you think, so he played at Mercer, they just moved conferences. They went from like the Sun Belt to, I think it was the Southern Conference. Might have that wrong. But basically played it at some lower tier conferences. Mercer's been a really good school the past few years, though. Do you think, like, what's your worry for the Cody Doolin problem where he comes to UNLV and struggles because it's clearly a step up in competition?
I think you are a little comforted by the fact that he's clearly, athleticism is not a problem.
Yeah.
Like he was more of a recruit coming out of high school than Cody Doolin was. Cody Doolin was sort of always a low major guy. Nwamu had the athleticism to play up, and he still does. Whereas Doolin had some problems adjusting to, you know, faster players and things like that. I think Nwamu, you're not really concerned about him being able to match up with a Mountain West level of competition in terms of, you know, just pure physical skills. Like, he's big enough, he's quick enough, he's strong enough. So you're not worried about any of those things. You would just be worried about the performance, running the plays, shooting the ball. Like, that's the only things that you would have to be concerned with, and he's done that thus far in his career.
Also, just from what I'm assuming, he's not going to be your top option. And not that Cody Doolin was the top option, but Cody Doolin was expected to, I mean, I hadn't been around UNLV before, but I got the sense, like, Cody Doolin's the savior at point guard is what people were expecting. And he was expected to be able to run an offense and do all that and didn't quite meet those. Nwamu's not going to have to handle the ball. He's not going to have to bring it up against presses all by himself, and he's not going to have to set up the half-court offense. And he's not going to be the guy you look to score 17, 18 points a game. You'd be more looking for him to get you, 11 points per game. So I think the pressure would be a little bit less on him. If you could pick one, would you rather have Nigel Williams-Goss for two seasons but not next year, or Ike Nwamu for 1 year next season?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't really know that. Like, you've seen Nwamu play. You're pretty familiar with him. I don't know that much about him beyond the stats. Like, I'm judging basically, solely on his box scores and his, highlight tapes. Tough. Like, you kind of, like, Nwamu is such a good fit this year in terms of roster construction, and he's, you have Zimmerman this year, you kind of want to take advantage of that. You don't know if he's going to be here beyond that. But Williams-Goss is an actual point guard. I know you're not as high on him as everyone else around UNLV is, but this is a program that still is just, like, thirsting. There's absolutely thirsting for a point guard. I think popular opinion would be go with Williams-Goss easily. I think I would go there, not quite as the gap wouldn't be quite as wide, but I think I would pick Williams-Goss for 2 years. Because 2 years, I'm not sure what they're going to be doing for point guard after this season, so he kind of sees that's a good fit as well.
I would take Ike. I love Ike. I don't like Nigel Williams-Goss. The only reason I wouldn't take Ike is because I'd only get him for 1 year. That's the only reason that I would consider Nigel Williams-Goss, but in the end, I'd still take Ike Nwamu for 1 year over Nigel Williams-Goss for the two after that. Don't have a point guard. Pat McCaw can play point guard if you need him to. Like, I'm not worried about that. And I don't want Nigel Williams-Goss being the guy on my team that needs to take 15, 16, 17 shots a game because he's not efficient. So give me Ike Nwamu over Nigel Williams-Goss. If you're UNLV, though, like, if Dave Rice is able to get both of them, that's like a really good job on the transfer market. Yeah.
They can get them both. They've got the scholarship spots, and they're the finalists. They're in the final round for both of them. So
I haven't looked at any of the lists, but I'd imagine Nigel Williams-Goss and Ike Nwamu are both top 10 or at least top 15 transfers. Like, that would be like Steven Zimmerman, Derek Jones, Jalen Poyser, maybe Justin Jackson, and these two would be quite the off-season haul for Dave Rice.
That, it's another, if Justin Jackson reclassifies, I'd have to imagine, I've written this, I think, I'd imagine that they would move up into the top five in most, you know, rankings for incoming classes. And I think they were top five last year as well, so it'd be 2 years in a row with the top five classes.
Would this be his best one ever? Like, if you can take into account Zimmerman, two transfers that have scored like 15 points a game at the D1 level already, like, that's got to be your best, right?
I think the Zimmerman thing was huge, just because of like how long they were after him and how much they put into him, and just the fact that when you get a guy, you know, like a 7-footer, top 10, like who's like in your backyard, and like, you know, your brother is coaching him in high school, and your son is playing on his high school team, and you've just got like so many ties to him. To lose that guy and watch him go out of state would have been like a big blow. So that is, it was huge. Not just for on the court reasons, but just for the sake of the program to sort of keep him around and reel him in. So I think this is probably the biggest class that they've brought in.
All right, we're gonna play a game. All right, are you ready for this game?
Okay.
I guess I could tell you how the game is. I'm gonna give you like a category, and you tell me which player is the best at that category.
Okay.
For next season. All right. Who next year is gonna be the best on the block scorer in the first game?
The first game on the block scorer. Are we talking big man only?
If you think it's not a big man, go for it.
Okay, I'm gonna take Zimmerman.
Okay, I mean I think at the end of the year that'll be the obvious choice, but I don't know if like right away if it's gonna be Zimmerman.
Even though like Wood, I don't think he's a pure post player. I think he's more of a stretch like face up player. I think he'll probably be there when they want to throw it into the post and get a bucket. I think Zimmerman will be that guy.
Who is going to be the best next year at getting all the way to the rim and finishing?
Getting all the way to the rim and finishing. They run through this roster. I'm going to say Patrick McCaw. Like, I know he wasn't a big finisher this year, but running through guys one by one, I don't know if I'm remembering everyone. I don't think Cornish was not a good finisher. Who do you think? Is McCaw the right answer? I'm assuming
they
all have correct answers. I'm assuming you have all the answers.
Oh, no, they don't have. I don't have correct answers. No, like, it's whatever you want to answer. To me, like, right now, the guys, for sure, it's McCaw, which isn't good because Pat McCaw didn't really get to the rim a whole lot last year. He penetrated and kicked a lot, but he didn't actually get to the rim himself. That's where I think, like, Ike Nwamu is a fantastic fit because that's what he does. Like, he gets to the rim and scores. So that's like a big hole. I guess you could say you could say Dwayne Morgan could do it, but we didn't see that enough, I think, to say yes, that's him. All right, next one. Best one-on-one post defender.
I'm going to go with Okonobo just because he's the most experienced guy. Like, he's got a full year of experience, like as a starter playing big minutes. He's a big shot blocker. I think he was their best post defender this year by synergy numbers. So I think Okonobo is the pick there, unless you're expecting Carter or Zimmerman to just come in and be unbelievable. I think Okonobo is the guy there.
I don't know the answer to the question because I would want to say Okonobo, but most of what he did that was good on defense last year was coming over to help.
Yeah,
and so like I didn't feel like one-on-one he did anything special. He was pretty good against Jakob Poeltl in Utah in the first half, but the second half Utah figured him out and figured how to score around him. So I'd lean towards him, but I don't know that. Give me your top two best perimeter defenders.
Patrick McCaw.
Is he number one?
Number one.
Okay.
He was their best perimeter defender this year by synergy, just raw numbers. I think Kendrick was like their best defender, just judging by the numbers and like the assignments he took on. But McCaw, I think, had the lowest points per against. So McCaw number one.
Is there a number two? Like, I don't think there's a number two right now.
Yeah, like, Cornish was not special as a freshman. Sears, wait and see. I don't know about him on that end. I think you're hoping that Sears is athletic enough and quick enough, which we see in practice, but you don't know if it's going to translate. But I think you're hoping that he's athletic and quick enough to at least give you some resistance at point guard.
Yeah, I don't know who the second best one is. All right, let's assume Ike Nwamu is on the team. Rank 1, 2, and 3 the best dunkers next year.
Nwamu number 1. Derek Jones number 2.
There you go.
I can't give it to a freshman. I know he's won every dunk contest he's ever been in. I don't know if I can just give it to a freshman just coming in like that. I'm going to see him earn it on Scarlet and Gray Day. And then Zimmerman, I guess, number 3. Even though no one likes to watch big men dunk, but...
That's I told you, we need the Pat McCaw alley-oop counter. Like, if Nwamu comes to this team, UNLV's going to lead the nation in dunks. And I'm perfectly fine if they try to dunk on everyone on every possession. Like, they're going to be a ton of fun. They're going to be fun as it is. If Nwamu comes here, like, they need to just have dunk contests, like, every day in practice so that we can watch that.
Well,
like, because that's going
to
be...
Well, they need to start off by reinstating the dunk contest at the Midnight Madness event or the Scarlet and Gray Showcase, which they didn't do last year. So, I mean, you would hope that they would with all these... If they have this collection of dunking talent, that they would do something like that for the fans. But, like, let's see... One step at a time.
All right. Who is the best shooter on the team? I know Cornish has the best percentage, but do you think he is the best shooter on the team?
I think it's going to be McCaw. Like, the very first thing that stood out to me, like, watching him in the preseason practices, but when he was still, like, the 10th guy, and he was the 5th guy in the recruiting class, and he was sort of the afterthought, like, very first thing that stood out to me was, like, just how solid his stroke was. Just, like, how solid and repeatable. It looks the same. It's very locked in. It's efficient. It's, like, he's got it pretty locked in. Like, I love his stroke. I think that McCaw will end up being, like, their top shooting option.
I think when Zimmerman committed, I think it was Doug Gottlieb that tweeted, like, UNLV is stacked, they just need shooting. I don't really agree. I think UNLV has good enough shooting. And especially if they get Nwamu, then they've got, like, 3 guys that I trust a lot to shoot threes in McCaw's, Cornish, and Nwamu.
And especially if Seegers lives up to his, 42% that he shot as his last year. At Rutgers, if he lives up to that, then yeah, you've got plenty of shooting. You've got like a nice entire like perimeter rotation of guys that can knock down shots.
Yeah, and then plus Zimmerman works, assuming he's going to be able to shoot and stretch the floor. So like I think UNLV's going to be just fine shooting next year. Especially if Nwamu comes. God, I hope they get Nwamu. Like, I really want to watch him. Like, there's 5 or 6 guys that I covered a game or multiple games when I did Ole Miss, and he's one of them that I'm just like, I want to see him play as much as I can. So I love him more than I should, and I will admit that over and over.
You worried about a sophomore slump for any of these shooters? Cornish is just like an obvious like regression.
Yeah, obvious, like,
obvious regression candidate. Like, he, no one shoots 50%, from 3-point range. And college basketball in itself is such a small sample size. Like, I'm not sure how many 3-pointers he took this year, but I'm guessing probably like somewhere around 50, like somewhere in that range. Like, that's a small sample size. So what if he comes back next year and just due to natural regression, he makes, 30%?
What percentage, like, what's the low point where you say, okay, you're still a good shooter for Cornish next year?
I think for me, when I'm just eyeballing numbers, it's always been for college basketball, like 37, 38, percent is like decent. Like, you can't leave a guy that's shooting, 37. Even, like, 36 is probably, like, the low point. Like, I would not want to, like, rotate away from a guy that's shooting 36% from 3-point range.
I'd actually go a little bit lower.
Yeah.
I would. I mean, I was thinking like 33%.
I'm sure there's like an actual statistical. Point where, you know, the risks for and against like actually meet, and you can actually see it like on a graph, like at the percentage at which it helps you to shoot threes as opposed to where it's hurting you. But I'm just saying, just like from my natural inclination, if I'm looking down at the box score and I see someone shooting 35%, 36%, I'm like, yeah, he can shoot. Like he can shoot.
Are you aware of what happened in Jerome Seeger's last college game that he's played in?
No.
It was in the conference tournament against Louisville, when Louisville was number 5 in the country, and I don't remember the exact score, but it was something like 56-14 at halftime. Like the last college game that Jerome Seegers played in, they got obliterated, and it was not competitive, not close. Final score was 92-31 in a conference tournament game. It was 58-16 at halftime. That's the last college game that Jerome Seegers played in. So
I guess that could be cause for transfer.
I just wanted to throw that out because I discovered that a little while ago and I keep forgetting to mention it. But I just think it's hilarious, and it's also like, holy hell, he hasn't played in so long, and that was the last time he played a real game, like that. That would make, like, I wouldn't want to transfer and sit out a year, because I'd be like, I don't want to have my last game be 92-31. But anyway, that's Jerome Seegers. All right, Mike, so what annoys you?
What annoys me?
Do you want me to like sort of give a preface to this, or do you want to give the whole story?
I'll take people through it.
Okay.
I'll paint a word picture for these for our listeners. So this was last week, like Tuesday or Wednesday, and I was going home, and I stopped at the supermarket to grab stuff for dinner, and you know, I can't cook anything, so it was a very quick trip. It was like I grabbed some chicken breasts, I grabbed some vegetables, and I was out of there. It's in and out, under 10 minutes. Got back out to my car. Broad daylight, sunny day, middle of the parking lot, broken into, everything gone. Like, my laptop was gone, my Sirius radio was gone, the change from my, like, change tray was gone, my breath mints that I keep in my center console were gone. Like, these guys...
The breath mints!
Yeah, and it wasn't even a full canister. I was running low, and then, like, they grabbed everything. And so... So I've been working, you know, off my secondary, like they took my work laptop. So all of my run rev stuff, my entire archives, everything that I've worked so hard to build is gone. So that's gone. And then, so I've been working off my home PC since then. But like, I don't know how they even broke into it. Like the doors were locked, the windows were up. I came back and the doors were like just unlocked and stuff was gone. So however they did it, I just tip my cap. If they can get in and out in under 10 minutes in daylight in a busy parking lot.
Don't tip your cap though. Don't tip your cap.
What do you want me to do? Like I filed a police report and everything, but like they're never going to care. If these guys were good enough to get into my car and do all that so quickly without leaving, you know, any trace, like I'm sure that they've sold off all that Run Rev's proprietary information, and then, you know, they're sitting on a sunny island somewhere. But that's not the thing that annoys me. Like, that happens. You know, you live in a city, things that, you know, your car can get broken into, that can happen. My fault for leaving my laptop bag in there. You know, what are you going to do? I'm too lazy to lug it around. So that doesn't annoy me. What annoys me is I'm kind of old school, so I have a collection of CDs that I keep in my car. You know, just once in a while, maybe I'll feel like listening to a CD, you know, front to back, so I'll throw it in there. So I've probably got... Between, like, the side pocket on my front door, I've probably got, like, 8 CDs there. And then in my center console, I probably got, like, another 7 or 8 CDs. None of the ones on my front door were taken. The center console, some of them were strewn about. Like, so someone had flipped through them. So I had to, like, recollect them. I put them back in the center console. And then I noticed that one was missing. So this person, like, went, they took the time to rifle through my CDs. Saw my music selection, didn't think anything was worth taking except one CD. And the thing that annoys me is that I can't figure out which CD it was. Like, I'm going through my memory bank saying, like, what did I have in here? But you know how it is? Like, you've had it there for so long. And, like, if someone takes one thing from your collection, it's like I can't figure out what it was until I want to. At some point, I'm sure I'll want to listen to it, and I'll reach for it, and I'll say, oh, it's not there. And the light will go on, and I'll say, oh, that's the one they took. But for now, I just – it's a mystery because they didn't like any of the other CDs. Obviously, they're grabbing everything. These people are grabbing breath mints out of my car. And they thought so little of my musical tastes that they left all the CDs, except one. So they respected one of my choices. I would just like to know what it is. Like I told them, if they happen to be listening to this podcast, I ain't mad about the break-in. Like, props to you. You did a good job. I was in there for 10 minutes. I came back. There was no one in sight. Everything was gone. You did your job. You beat me. Congratulations. I ain't mad about it. Just, you know, make a dummy email account. Tell me what CD it was.
Let me. Why do you have CDs? Like, you know, we have technology that has surpassed that.
I know, but it's an older car. It's a 2003 car. It's got a CD player in it. I grew up in the I owned CDs before like digital technology came along. So I have CDs just left over. I don't buy CDs anymore. But I just have CDs like left over that I like to listen to once in a while. I don't drive around with like a 5 CD changer, you know, in my remote, and I'm like clicking the changer in my trunk and like loading CD. It's not like that. It's just like once in a while I'll want to listen to, you know, whatever CD like all the way through. So I'll just throw it in.
Wasn't that the strangest thing to put CD changer in the trunk?
Yeah, and it was like a 5. You could load in like 5 CDs, but then you have to pick like which CD it was you wanted, and then you'd have to like find it. It was very complicated.
My older brother had a car that had that, and it just always blew my mind. I was like, why the hell I got to put the CDs in the trunk?
So if, in case you want to switch one out, you just pull over to the side of the road, pop the trunk, lug your CD booklet over into the back. Yeah. So you look at...
Okay, let me... So you have an older car. You don't have an aux cord, I take it, or input.
No.
Okay, I don't either. Do you have a tape player in your car?
I don't. So what I do have is, if I want to play like MP3s, I have, it's kind of like, it's not the best quality, but I have like a radio frequency thing where I can like plug in my iPod or whatever, and I can find like a radio station. That's how, like, but most of the time I'm listening to like satellite radio, which is the same thing. You just find a frequency that's like an open frequency, and you like tune your radio to it, and then it comes in. So if I wanted to play like MP3s like through my phone that way, I could do that.
That's where I'm at. My car is, it doesn't have a tape player, which, and it doesn't have an aux cord, so you got to go with the damn FM, I'm going to interrupt the signal and it's not going to work half the time, which is awful. Like, I had a car that had a tape player, and, you know, they just have a little, you plug in the tape cassette and it has the cord on it. Those things work so wonderful, but I don't have that car anymore. Our cars are in the middle of nowhere because we don't have the old enough technology for it to work good, but you don't have the new enough technology. I mean, hell, now I think you can just plug a USB in to new cars. You don't even need the aux cord. You just need the USB thing, and you can charge it and play your music through that all at once. So that annoys me, is the damn FM interrupter thing. I don't like those either. I actually, see, for this annoying thing, I actually have like 5 different things, but they're all kind of minor. And I'm kind of trying to figure out for next show if I should just do one of them or if I should just do all of them, since they're kind of minor.
You keep like a file, a note on your phone or something, where you just add, when things annoy you, you like add it to the file so you don't forget.
I was watching a basketball game and something happened and I was like, that always annoys me. I should mention that. And then I was like, I did type it into the notes on my phone. And then I was like, wait, I know like 2 other things that annoy me. And so I just typed them all out. So they're all there waiting.
What was the basketball thing?
Should I just go ahead and give one of them?
If you would like, I you also just spurred me to think of a basketball thing that annoys me that I was tweeting about recently.
All right, I'm gonna give you
okay.
One. And this is it's yelling and one when you don't get fast. And like I have come to the I am all aboard this rule change at every level of basketball. If you yell and one, and you miss the shot, and you don't get fouled. Like, there's no foul call. You get ejected on the spot. Like, you are ejected immediately from the game. Like, I get annoyed enough, like David West does it. I love David West, but David West does it all the time. And tons of players do it all the time. And you can hear it because, yay, technology, TV, we have microphones everywhere. You can always hear him yelling and one. And it just it annoys the hell out of me when they yell and one and miss the shot. Because that's like the first thing you need for an N1 is you have to actually make the shot. But it's just like you get hacked and you throw the shot up near the rim and you just yell and one. It's awful. And if you don't get fouled and miss, eject him right away. Get out of
and
here.
And for anyone who plays like pickup basketball, it definitely has permeated to the pickup level. Everyone has every court that you know where you're running a game has the and one guy who is just begging for and ones on every play.
It's like I am all for it. I don't care. I don't care if it's like game 7 of the finals and you got to eject LeBron because he yelled and one. Eject him. Like, get him out of there if he yells and one, misses the shot, and doesn't get fouled.
I'm talking like playground ball. People now, because of this, what you're talking about, where players yelling it, it's trickled down to people doing it on the playground where there are no free throws. There is no – you don't shoot free throws in pickup basketball. And yet people still yell and one as the shot's going up.
That's a good point. I had not extrapolated my hate enough to
people
that level.
People begging for a non-existent play.
Talking about pickup ball, I've had this thought for a while, but if you are not a good three-point shooter playing pickup, you should never agree to play by ones and twos.
Yeah, ones and twos it's obviously very, very weighted towards outside shooting.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people like realize that when they play, though. Like, I don't think they understand that ones and twos makes the three-point line that much big of a difference.
Yeah, if you get to that point where it's worth double, you pretty much don't even want to shoot anything except a layup inside the line.
Yeah, so I've had that thought for a while, but I don't feel like when I played pickup basketball in high school, I didn't realize that when I played pickup basketball in high school. Like, I never did. Like, I never had that thought. I just was like, yeah, whatever, ones and twos. But now it's like, that makes kind of a big difference.
Analytics.
I know. All right, what was your complaint about basketball?
My complaint is the move where someone shoots a jump shot, and then as they land, they just fall down in an attempt to get a foul call. You like that move? Do you like offensive players like flopping and like trying to draw foul calls? You like the James Harden style?
Yeah, like I mean, it doesn't bother me like it bothers some people. It's not like my favorite thing to watch, but yeah, I don't mind it.
I don't mind like James Harden if you're like driving in and you're bouncing off people. Like at least you're doing something. If you're doing the jump shot like fall, you're not doing. You're just falling down. Like if you put it just in isolation. Spot shadow on the player shooting a shot, you just see someone shoot a jumper and then fall down. And the thing that I don't like is that it's still new enough. The first guy I can remember doing it was Ben Gordon, who was sort of like it was like it probably happened once to him where he jumped, he didn't have enough space to land, so he fell down and he got the call. And then he just started doing it all the time. And then other players started noticing, and then it's now like a go-to move. Like Steph Curry does it all the time. If you watch the NBA players, you'll see a bunch of people doing it. And it's still new enough that the referees really haven't caught on yet. And there's an added emphasis on giving jump shooters like space to land now. That's one of like an emphasis that they've made in the last couple of years. That's why you're seeing like so many four-point plays nowadays. So combining refs looking for contact on jump shots and like, giving them space to land – and players like feeding off that by just falling down for no reason, even when they're not touched, and you get a lot of terrible, terrible foul calls on jumpers, which is like the last you should. If you're shooting a jump shot, you don't get the benefit of the doubt on foul calls.
Oh, you should. No, you should.
It's not. If you're being aggressive and driving to the basket, like I said, bouncing off people and you're going up and taking contact and driving through. Like, yeah, I guess you can give a star player the benefit of the doubt. If you're settling for a jump shot, you got to prove it to me. I need to see contact. I need to hear contact. I need to feel that contact if I'm going to give you a foul call on a jumper.
You know what I hate? is when people complain about the guy catches the ball at the three-point line, pump fakes, the defender jumps towards him, and then the guy goes to shoot and gets the foul. You know, the it was the Derek Marks Boise State NCAA tournament play where he didn't get the call.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm referring to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like, that's a foul 100% of the time. Do you agree?
Like
people hate offensive players that pump fake on the three-point line, and then they go up to shoot, and when they go up to shoot, they jump into the defender that is, like, flailing at them. They hate that.
I think I need to look at, like, the wording of the rule, because I think that it's you know it when you see, like, some of them are, like, legitimate fouls, but then I feel like some of them aren't. Like, it's one of those things, like, you know it when you see it. Like, if the defender is landing, you know, and you're late to make your move, and, like, the defender's already landed, and you take, like, a non-normal, like, jump. Like, people don't jump, like, at an 85-degree angle to the left when they shoot their jump shot. But you'll see John Wall, like, pump fake, and then he'll jump sideways, like, into someone as he's shooting. Like, that's not a natural thing.
See, but
if you can pump fake someone into the air legitimately and draw contact, like, that move's been around forever. Like, that's like a real basketball move.
But here's my problem is people complain about the offensive guy getting the foul, and if you don't call the foul, you're rewarding the defender for playing terrible defense. Like, if you bite on a pump fake, that's horrendous defense. Like, that's not something you want to do. And if you don't give the foul, you're basically saying, okay, you didn't do it. Like, you're rewarding the guy for playing just terrible defense. And if that happens within 5 feet of the basket, it's a foul every time and nobody cares. Like, if you pump fake under the basket and the guy jumps and then you decide to jump into him just looking for a foul, it's a foul every time and nobody complains about it. But if it happens on the three-point line, same exact thing, for some reason that's an issue.
It's probably because just aesthetically looking at it, you can sort of jump weirdly and contort your body on the inside and still, you know, have a legitimate shot, you know, to make your bucket. Whereas if you're, like, shooting a three-pointer and you take, like, a non-natural route in your jump, you have no chance of making that shot. And people recognize that. It just looks weirder when you're jumping from when it's out in space and you're further out. And people can, you know, it doesn't look right. It doesn't look natural.
All right. UNLV next year. They still only have three big men. Is that a problem?
Probably. Like, it was a problem this year.
How many scholarships do they have left?
They have three open scholarships.
So
Justin Jackson could be one if he reclassifies. And then they have two. So if they still have room to land both Nwamu and Williams-Goss, if that's the way they decide to go. Like, they have three spots. Those seem like the three closest moves to happening.
Wouldn't you rather have a big man than all three of those guys?
Maybe.
I feel like I would. To me, the farther I can get Dwayne Morgan away from playing post minutes, the better I am.
It depends on if they're the quality of the big men available. If you don't have a good big man ready to commit to you right now, you can't pass on Williams-Goss. You can't pass on Nwamu. You can't pass on those guys hoping that a big man is going to, you know, announce his transfer or some JUCO big man is going to, like, add you to his list. You've got to take, like, the bird in the hand. Like, if these guys are ready to commit and they're all quality players, like, you've got to take it and figure out the roster later.
I agree with getting the best players available. I just keep looking. I'm like, God, Dwayne Morgan's going to have to play on the post some more. And I'm like, no, thank you. That's not going to turn out good. All right. He's Mike Grimala over at runrevs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection. This has been the Towel Boys. Thanks for tuning in.